Well, thank you. And for those of you who are going to be participating in the Skeptics Forum, we are going to try to do live streaming here Monday night. And that's because so many of the Reasons to Believe chapters want to establish a Skeptics Forum, kind of like we do here every quarter. And so they've asked if we could set that up. We're going to do our best to try to get it set up. But it does mean if you come, you might be on the Internet. So keep that in mind. Some friends of ours in Arcadia lost their power, but we called them. They said, no problem, we have a generator. But the generator was not very high power. They could only sustain the essential electricity, which was basically their two TV sets. So the necessities of life were taken care of, they told us. So, no, for some reason, they didn't have enough power for the refrigerator. But they said, well, you know, the TV is more important than the refrigerator. So away they went on that. So I'm glad you're all here, and actually I was reading a report about how the life expectancy of the average American now stands at 78. It's been kind of stable there, even though medical advances have been going on. And of course they've been pointing out that because of the lack of exercise and obesity, this explains why the American life expectancy isn't increasing like it is in some other nations. On the other hand, what I found interesting in the report, they found one place here in America where people are living on an average of past 88 years, literally 10 years more than the average American lifespan. And it's right here in Southern California. It's basically Seventh-day Adventists living in Loma Linda live an average of more than 88 years, men and women. Well, what was really interesting is that they kind of dug into this and said, you know, what's really going on here? Well, you know, part of it is that they were surveying Seventh-day Adventists who regularly attend and participate in their church. So they looked at other denominations and discovered it doesn't depend on the denomination. It's not that you have to be a Seventh-day Adventist, but what really counts is whether or not you're a regular participant in a Christian denomination. This seems to be the critical factor, although they also pointed out that Seventh-day Adventists tend to have the lowest ratio of people who smoke and drink. But they looked into the vegetarian thing because they thought that might be a factor, but what they noticed is there's no difference between Seventh-day Adventists who are vegetarians and Seventh-day Adventists who are not vegetarians. So evidently that's not the key factor, but the smoking and drinking, of course, it would be a key factor. The other thing they notice is of all the Christian denominations, Seventh-day Adventists have the lowest propensity for obesity, so that would be a little bit of a factor too. But the bottom line is they began to study what is it about church attendance. And, you know, there's a spiritual foundation. It's a secular study, by the way, that they said, you know, it's the fact that there's a spiritual foundation. There's a sense of the importance of the family. There's a community that's there. But they said probably the most significant factor is that people who regularly attend church and participate in their churches have a sense of purpose in life and a sense of hope in their life. And they said that seems to be the critical factor determining how long you live. Do you have hope and do you have purpose? And everything else, how you live, your lifestyle, is secondary, depending upon hope and purpose. And that was significant for me because, you know, my mother was a nurse for most of her life. And her point is when patients lost hope and purpose, this is when things did not go well for them medically. And even people who are in dire medical straits, as long as they maintain that sense of hope and purpose, they had a better medical outcome than those that did not. Yeah.
Does this survey have anything to do with synagogues and the life expectancy?
Well, they also looked at Muslims and Jews and Buddhists, and they said, as if they were regularly participating in the life of their church community, that did have a factor, but they noticed the biggest was for those who are part of the evangelical Christian community.
Really? So the Jews would have a lesser...
Well, that's where they got into the sense, because they said the thing about Christians is they really preach this message of hope and purpose and give people sound reasons for that. The other thing that was not in the article that I thought was interesting is that it was this Loma Linda Seventh-day Adventist community that had the highest numbers. And, you know, I've spoken to that community quite frequently. I've done several services in the Loma Linda Hospital to the Seventh-day Adventist community. But one thing I noticed about that community of Seventh-day Adventists is they really have a strong emphasis on teaching as opposed to preaching. I mean, every time I've done an event to the Loma Linda Seventh-day Adventists, they've always had me speak, and then there'd be two people who would get up who took a different position than I did, and they would give a response. Then we'd have a dialogue about the differences in our theological perspectives on that particular issue.
Where is Loma?
Loma Linda? Well, it's basically out towards San Bernardino.
That's not too far.
No, it's not far. Yeah. Well, it's also, they got a good hospital there, too. I mean, that's probably a factor as well.
Yeah.
But I said, you know, when people are actually engaged like they are here in this class, where we take different perspectives and debate and engage one another and, you know, challenge one another and really engage our minds, that really kind of builds that sense of hope and purpose. And people, and that's one thing they point out in the study, is a big difference between church communities where there's engagement as opposed to where people come, listen, go home without talking to anybody. And therefore, they didn't get quite the number, say, with certain Roman Catholic communities where that's kind of the practice, or Eastern Orthodox, where people basically, it's kind of a mechanical thing. They go there every Sunday, but it's a short period of time. They hear a message. There's really no engagement. They go home. They said they notice higher numbers where there was actual engagement. And it's something I've said here in the class. When you go through the New Testament epistles, the command given to the leaders of the church is to teach and preach. And there's two different Greek words for teaching and preaching. Preaching is where someone gets up in front of the congregation, gives a sermon, and then exhorts people to change their life behavior as a result of the message. Teaching is where there's instruction and engagement, where people are learning so that their minds will be transformed, and that will engender a change in character. We're to do both. And I think what this study was pointing out is you get the best results in terms of life expectancy, where both is going on. But the key thing they pointed out, it must be taking place on a regular basis. They noticed a real difference between Christmas Easter Christians and those who are there every Sunday. In the back.
Yeah, did they keep those studies on the Mormons? Because this is maybe even better than the Seventh-day Adventists.
Well, but, you know, I saw another study where it talked about how generous people are, and it looked at the giving patterns, say, of Mormons and Seventh-day Adventists. And what's interesting, they said Seventh-day Adventists have the highest giving in terms of percentage of their income of any mainline denomination. However, the caveat was generosity towards the church. They actually found that evangelical Christians attending non-denominational churches are much more generous than the Seventh-day Adventists if you count their total giving to the mission of the Christian enterprise. That in many mainline denominations, all the giving is towards the church, where they've noticed that people who attend churches like Sierra Madre Congregational Church, they not only give to the church, they give to a number of missionary and evangelistic outreaches as well, sometimes equivalent to what they give to the church. And so we look at that. That's where you see the highest generosity manifested. And so, yes.
I can answer his question. Obviously, Mormonism is my expertise.
Right.
The life expectancy in the LDS Church is not as great for several reasons. Obesity is a big problem. The Mormon Church has the highest rate of suicide because of the perfectionism that's demanded. And likewise, obviously, the abuse of prescription medication is the highest among Mormons also.
Yeah.
Because they have lots of children, they have a highest percentage who live under poverty also. So all those factors take a real toll on their life expectancy.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Appreciate that, Dave. Yes.
What was the name of the survey again?
Oh, I can't.
Okay.
If you, you can find it, you can Google it and you'll find it.
What would we Google?
What would you Google? Life expectancy. Yeah, go ahead. Maybe you know where it is.
There's a book called Blue Zone.
Called what?
Blue Zone.
Blue Zone?
Zone, yeah.
Z-O-N-S. Z-O-N-S? Yeah. Right. Well, there's been numerous studies like this over the years. What I found interesting about this study, I think was announced just this morning, was that it really got into what is it about church behavior and church engagement that really seems to be the big factor. So, but they said, you know, obviously, you know, how you live makes a big difference, but it's not just how you live physically, it's how you live mentally and spiritually that seems to be a factor. And again, it underlines what we see in Genesis 1. We human beings are body, soul, and spirit. And you get the best results where all three components are following the advice that you see in Scripture. I mean, if you look at the Levitical law, it tells you how we should live our lives physically so we would get the best health results. But also, we are to live our lives in a way that is mentally challenging and spiritually challenging. I mean, we've all heard studies that the best way to prevent getting dementia and Alzheimer's is to keep your mind active. And one way you can keep your mind active is to be involved in a church community where they're worshiping God with all of their minds. So, a little bit of a plug to keep on coming, all right?
They do a lifespan of this class.
Well, you know, I can tell you another story. I ran into a fellow who was a professional fundraiser for non-profit Christian organizations. And he says, you know, where most non-profits get a significant chunk of their money, if not the majority of their money, is in bequests. You know, when somebody dies, they have a will and so much money gets designated towards a non-profit corporation. And he says, as professional fundraisers, we know that's kind of the easiest way to raise significant funds. And so our practice is to try to get people to, you know, really consider setting up either some kind of, I forget the technical term for it, not a will, but
a charitable trust,
right. But he says there's a real problem when you're trying to do this for Christian nonprofits. That's because Christians tend to live 8 years longer than the rest of the population. So you have to wait a lot longer to get the resources than you otherwise would. So, but I'll tell you the thing I've noticed at Reasons to Believe. Everyone who has put us in their bequests, we've seen their giving for the organization go up. Because after all, you want to see things happen within your own life, not wait until after you're gone and have to watch from heaven. And you like to see it take place in both cases. So, but it is interesting how there was that 8-year difference. So, anyways, we're not only here to live, but also we have hope for the life beyond. Hey, let me just jump into this, because we've been trying to make progress on this anthropic principle in equality for a couple of weeks now. And I'd really like to try to get through all this stuff. I got a ton of other scientific discoveries I could talk to you about, but let me just dive in here. Maybe I'll bring those discoveries with me tonight, and then we can talk about them as we have some fellowship with one another. But one of the points that we've been making is that you need a minimum of 14 billion years approximately to bring human beings upon the cosmic scene if we're talking a universe that's governed by gravity, electromagnetism, laws of thermodynamics, and the nuclear laws. But that the window in which we can exist in a civilized state, according to calculations we've made at Reasons to Believe, can't be longer than 20,000 years. If you look at the work by Frank Tipler and John Barrow, it can't be more than 41,000 years. That's what's called the anthropic principle inequality, that the physics that demands that we take 14 billion years to prepare a home for humanity also demands that we can't live in a civilized state for anything longer than about 40,000 years. And what I've been doing these past couple of weeks is giving you some background as to why this is true. And we started off by making the point that in order to have advanced life existing on a planet, that planet must be super enriched with uranium and thorium. Those are long-lived radiometric elements. And if you look at planet Earth, we have 23,000 times as much thorium as other Earth-like planets would be expected to contain, and 16,000 times as much uranium. Uranium is actually more abundant than tin and antimony, for example. And the reason why you need all that uranium and thorium, it's critical to establish a strong, stable magnetic field, which again is critical to protect advanced life from deadly cosmic and solar radiation. It's also critical to prevent the planet's atmosphere from being sputtered away by the charged particles that come out from the sun. And also, you need that uranium and thorium to sustain plate tectonics so that you wind up with a planet that transforms from a water world to a world where you've got oceans and continents together. That's something you see in Genesis 1. Our planet Earth starts off with water over the whole surface of the Earth, but we see in Creation Day 3 that we get the continents showing up, so we have both continents and oceans together. That's critical to recycle the nutrients. It's also critical so you've got a place where human beings can live. I mean, we don't do too well trying to set up a civilization where we're having to tread water for all of our lives. So you kind of want some dry ground around there. And then you also need a large ocean so you can set up a sufficient water cycle to water the land masses so that you can grow food there. And last week we talked about how the sun changes its brightness over its history. I mean, when it's very young, it's accumulating mass. And then as it gets a little bit older, it begins to shed mass. Then it stops shedding mass, but at that point the sun is already igniting nuclear fusion, where we get hydrogen being transformed into helium in the core of the sun. We need to realize the sun is a gigantic hydrogen bomb. And as we have hydrogen transformed into helium through nuclear fusion, that raises the density of the core of the sun, which causes the nuclear furnace of the sun to burn more efficiently. So as time goes on, as you can see in these graphs, once you get past the accumulation of mass and the shedding of mass, and the reason why it's so dramatic when the sun is accumulating mass and shedding mass, the luminosity of a star is proportional to the fourth power of its mass. So if the sun were to lose, say, 20% of its mass, that means that it's going to become 100% dimmer than it was before. And so that's why you see that dramatic increase in the solar luminosity to where it was twice as bright as it is now. Then it sheds mass and literally drops down to about 85% of its present brightness. But once that mass accumulation and shedding subsides, then we get a slow brightening of the sun. Now the argument here is there's a particular luminosity that's ideal for advanced life, and that's where we are right now. Now we were there two other times before, but at these two times the sun's luminosity was changing rapidly. You want to be the place where it's changing slowly. And this is where we are right now. So that's one reason why you want to wait about 4.5 billion years after that moment when the universe reaches maximum abundance of uranium and thorium. I mean, as the universe gets older and older, it produces more and more stars. The giant stars make the uranium and thorium, but there comes a time when star formation begins to subside. Remember I showed you that graph? The universe reaches maximum uranium and thorium abundance when it's a little more than 9 billion years. But this explains why you want to wait an additional 4.6 billion years thereafter before you bring humans upon the scene. Yes?
Isn't our uranium and thorium primordial to the Earth so that it was there back in that time when the sun was young anyway?
Yes, we get three different infusions of uranium and thorium. There are more, but there are three that are particularly significant. One happens at the date that the Earth is formed, and it formed at the time when uranium and thorium were maximally abundant in the history of the universe. So the date when the solar system formed is significant. And where the solar system formed is also significant. It formed in a very big open star cluster where it was filled with supernova eruptions at the time of the formation of the solar system that would have super enriched our solar system with uranium and thorium. And then you have the collision of the body that's twice as massive as Mars with the Earth when the Earth is about 30 or 40 million years old. That would have significantly enhanced the uranium-thorium abundance because a collision between the two planets, Earth and a planet twice as massive as Mars, would have caused a transfer of the heavy element material from the collider into the core of the Earth, and the light element material got exploded away, some of which formed the Moon. So it explains why the Moon is a lighter composition. The late heavy bombardment, which occurred 700 million years thereafter, when Saturn and Jupiter reached what's called a 1-2 resonance, where Jupiter made exactly two orbits for every single orbit of Saturn, that caused a massive rush of large meteorites, asteroids, and comets into the inner solar system, which would have resulted in a further enrichment. So it was those four events that explain why we have so much more uranium and thorium than what we'd expect in a typical Earth planet, Earth-sized planet existing elsewhere in our galaxy today. Yes?
With regard to mass luminosity, if the sun loses 20% in mass, and that would decrease the luminosity about 60%, I think you said 100, but it would be about 60%.
Well, it's 1.2 times 1.2 times 1.2 times 1.2. Okay. When it's increasing in mass, the luminosity will go up by about the fourth power of the mass. And then when it's decreasing in mass, it goes the other way.
So if it decreased 20%, that would result in a reduction of 60%.
I think it's a little bit more than that. I mean, all of you can do the math. 1.2 times 1.2 is 1.44. 1.44 times 1.2, then multiply that by 1.2. Now, you multiply it all the way through. Anyway, work out the math. It's not exactly 100%, but it's close. Maybe someone can do that while I'm talking and give us the exact number. But we're still trying to debate just exactly how much mass the sun lost from maximum mass to the present. And if you're interested, I've got four articles on this that are up on our reasons.org website. It's called Today's New Reason to Believe. I did a four-part study on what's called the faint sun paradox. I also did a four-part article series on the history of the solar system and how the first billion years of the history of our solar system really explains why we're very likely the only planet in the universe that has the capacity to support an advanced life because of all amazing fine-tuning events that take place at that time. So maybe we should give a prize for the first person that comes up with that 1.2 times 1.2. Oh, you already got it. She's got a calculator here.
How many?
Yeah.
2.0736.
So it's 2.07. So that's a little more than 100%. Okay, very good. We'll see if we can come up with some prize this evening. So.
Some cash-like prize.
Well, I was thinking of some kind of booby prize, but whatever. we'll have fun tonight.
Put you first in the line for the potluck.
There you go. So, last in the line for dessert. I don't know how that works. Okay, yes.
That narrows time frame there, the first and second. Of the,
right.
So,
when it's like here and here.
So what would have prevented God, but I don't know. What would have prevented humans to have developed at that time?
Okay, I think what you're saying is, okay, maybe these two earlier times where you got the idea of luminosity, you could have humans existing for a very brief period of time. Yeah. Here's why it doesn't work. Because you got another problem with the sun. Remember last time, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I said stars are like human beings. They're unstable when they're young. They're unstable when they're old. They're maximally stable when they're middle age. And this is what the solar flaring activity looks like over the history of the sun. And so those two earlier epochs where you had the right luminosity, you've got the sun pouring out these nasty flares that bathe the planet with lots of X-rays, lots of particle radiation. And this is a time when the sun's luminosity is varying significantly. Not a good time to have advanced human civilization. you really need to wait to a time when the sun has the minimum flaring activity and the maximum luminosity stability, and that happens when it's almost exactly halfway through its nuclear burning cycle, which is 4.57 billion years. And as I mentioned the last time I was here with you, a couple of weeks ago, we have a sun that has the optimal mass for maximum luminosity stability. Stars that are more massive than our sun are more unstable. Stars that are less massive than our sun are more unstable. That's why you have to be orbiting a star exactly at the sun. It's one of the reasons that I, critique my friends who are searching for extraterrestrial intelligent life. If you're not looking at a star that has exactly the mass of the sun, there's no way there could be a planet orbiting that star that would have advanced life on it. There's other features, too. I mean, you really have to have virtually an exact twin of the sun for it to be a candidate for having a planet orbiting it with advanced life. And the problem is every star candidate that's on the list for the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life fails, and that the star is not an exact twin. And therefore, we have no candidates other than our solar system. Let me just finish this and I'll take a couple more questions. The flaring minimum occurs when the sun is 4.57 billion years old, its current age. And what also astronomers noted about 7 years ago when they were looking at neutrinos coming out of the sun, they noted that the sun entered an extremely stable luminosity phase in its burning history beginning 50,000 years ago. And that extreme solar luminosity stability can last a maximum of 50,000 more years. So at least gives you a feel for why this inequality is true, why it takes about 14 billion years to prepare a home for us, but why we can only live in a civilized state for a few tens of thousands of years. I mean, this tells you right away, you only got a window of time that's 100,000 years wide, but that's not the only window of time. There's many windows of time you have to meet, and when you put them all together, it really does shrink down to about 20,000 years. You had your hand up.
Yeah, wondering, some of these numbers you're putting, 40,000 years, 100,000 years, 20,000 years, are fairly long times, but is there something we can learn from the peak to peak, or valley to valley of the solar fluctuation, the 11 or 22-year solar cycles, that pertains to this at all?
Well, that's been speculated. And, of course, if you go online, you'll see a lot of people really concerned that next year is 2012, solar maximum, and that conditions are going to get extreme during solar maximum. And, if you look at all the literature, it is true that there's a greater health risk when you're at solar maximum than when you're at solar minimum. But what's interesting, it's only been in the last year that they've been able to measure the difference. So medical studies done 10 years ago, 20 years ago, could not tell the difference between solar minimum and solar maximum. And I think I actually reported on that here in the class, that about this research study where they looked at Dutch women, about a million Dutch women. And the reason why they picked on that population segment, this is where they had faithful, there was a law that actually required every woman in this particular region of the Netherlands that they had to have an annual pap smear. And they had like 20 years of faithful records of all the women living in that area. And they were able to detect a very slight increase and cancer incidence and other cervical diseases at solar maximum compared to solar minimum. And then they also noted in the same study where they looked at men, but they didn't have that many. They only had actually one guy. But it was a guy, it was a medical doctor at the Mayo Clinic. And what made the study interesting is that he would measure his vitals five times a day. And he did it for the same period of 20 years that this Dutch female study was being done. So he measured things like blood pressure. He measured his heart rate. There were six things that he measured. His temperature. things like that. And he noticed that there was an increase at solar maximum compared to solar minimum. But again, if it wasn't for the faithfulness of that doctor measuring himself five times a day and six bodily vitals, nobody would have ever picked it up. And the difference was slight. So yeah, you are at a greater health risk at solar maximum, but I say I wouldn't worry about it. It's not going to be, I mean, you're at greater risk just driving the streets around here. So, yes.
Does the general scientific community pretty much agree with your statement about the solar twin logic? And if so, why don't they go after that rather than planets?
Well, it's much cheaper to go after the star than to go after the planets. I mean, if your real goal is to try to find a planet like Earth that could support advanced life, then measuring the star's characteristics is really the way to go. And if you find some star candidates, then you can go deeper and see if there are planets there. That would be the most cost-effective way to do that kind of research, which tells me that there isn't enough publicity yet within the astronomical community on the search for a solar twin, even though the research has been going on for 50 years.
But if you were to, let's say, you had your general scientific community, let's say, in this room, hypothetically,
well,
and you were to ask them what you need a virtual identical solar twin to have a planet capable of supporting life, would they generally agree with you?
They wouldn't, for the following reason. It's the same thing as what's happened in the scientific community on the anthropic principle. I've mentioned here in the class that if you look at the astronomical literature, the anthropic principle is really the prebiotic principle. And so instead of looking at the conditions that you need within the universe and our galaxy and the planetary system so that you could have the equivalent of human life, they're really only looking at what do you need to have a scenario where you're going to get the prebiotics that might make possible the emergence of a simple life form. And clearly, the characteristics are far less demanding for a prebiotic situation than it would be for advanced life. Well, likewise, in this astrobiological search, what they're really looking for is what do we need to have a planet that can sustain life by any description for any period of time. And so what I find frustrating is that you see astronomers, for example, looking at extremophiles here on planet Earth, bacteria that live under very extreme conditions, and therefore they think that if they can find a planet with those same extreme conditions, that life could be there. Well, there was a classic article written about 5 years ago in the journal Astrobiology with the title, Extremophiles Are Irrelevant to the Origin of Life. That yes, here on planet Earth, bacterial life forms can exist under highly acidic conditions, or they can exist under very salty conditions, or high pressure conditions, freezing conditions, near boiling conditions, but they can't originate under those conditions. And that the only reason why we have a planet with extremophiles is because we have a planet that's super enriched with mesophiles. That's a term for life living under benign conditions. So without the mesophiles, you're not going to get the extremophiles. The mesophiles actually provide the food chain resources that make possible the existence of the extremophiles. And one of the reasons why extremophiles are irrelevant to the origin of life is that you can't originate life under those acidic conditions or high temperature conditions or freezing conditions. And moreover, when you look at these extremophile life forms, they're barely alive. For example, you do find bacteria that can live near uranium resources where they're being bathed with radiation. They can live under high radiation conditions. But it's a life form that expends almost all of its energy in repairing damage to the system. And you see that in all these extremophiles. And unlike the mesophiles, there's all this complex biochemistry embedded in these extremophiles that repairs the damage from living under these extreme conditions, which means that the problem for the origin of life for extremophiles is orders of magnitude greater than it would be for the mesophiles, because you have to have all this extra biochemical complexity just to take care of being able to survive under those extreme conditions. And in one sense, you can argue that we human beings are extremophiles because we live under a high oxygen environment. And oxygen is very challenging. I mean, that's why you want to take lots of antioxidants in your diet, right? So tonight, the fruits and vegetables are what you want to feast on, because that will give you the antioxidants. It'll help deal with the damage you get from all the oxidizing effects of the other food that you eat. I mean, we live in an environment where the atmosphere is 21% oxygen. And our body is filled with complex biochemistry to deal with the damage that that high oxygen brings about. And so the first life forms show up on planet Earth when the oxygen levels were much less. I think your hand was first, then we'll come back here. Yes?
You know, when you talk about an exact solar twin, within what percentage of the mass of our sun would that be? And then another two questions. How many, have you ever calculated how many of those you would expect to find in the Milky Way, or how many you would expect to find in the whole universe?
Well, we do find stars that have virtually the identical mass of our star, the sun, but they're not the same age as our sun. And they don't have the same abundance characteristics as our sun. What we've been noticing is stars that are the same age and the same mass of our sun have a different lithium abundance than our sun does. And this is a critical factor for whether or not you could have advanced life. But even when I read the literature where they're looking for twins of the sun, again, it's defined in such a way is what characteristics of a star do we need to support the most primitive bacterium? In my opinion, that's not really the exact twin that we're needing for the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. And so the solar characteristics become much more demanding if we're talking about sustaining a planet where you can have bacteria for 3 billion years. I mean, if you go on our website, it's just as easy as this. It's reasons.org/fine-tuning. Up will pop a 300-page long compendium. It was going to be an appendix in my book for More Than a Theory, but when the publisher said 300 pages, they said, put it up on the web. So it's up on the web. It's free. We don't charge for it. But what you'll notice there is we look at all these characteristics, for example, of the star, and we break it into 6 different categories. But, for example, there's a category. What stellar characteristics do you need to sustain a planet orbiting that star that can support bacteria for 90 days or less? Well, if it's only 90 days or less, that means you can consume all the nutrients and not have to worry about recycling the nutrients. So the conditions are much less demanding. And you know, we would expect to have a fairly broad range of characteristics that we would identify as, quote, an exact solar twin. But then if you talk about what do you need if you're going to have bacteria for 3 billion years, say, why 3 billion years? That's the minimum time to chemically transform a planet so it can sustain advanced life. I mean, our planet Earth began with metals in soluble form that would have been deadly poison to advanced life. It took 3 billion years of sulfate-reducing bacterial activity to transform those metals into a chemical state that would have been safe for advanced life. So that was one reason when our family celebrated Thanksgiving, we had a word of thanks for the sulfate-reducing bacteria. Because without that, we wouldn't have been around to enjoy our Thanksgiving dinner.
We do eat turkey at Thanksgiving.
We do eat turkey at Thanksgiving. So we thank God for the tryptophan that's in the turkey. So. Yes.
Well, there's the interesting about the extremophiles, because I think I've seen several articles that throw out the possibility that life first originated in hydrothermal vents or near hydrothermal vents, that this what you're saying would rule that out.
Well, it was actually Stanley Miller's research team that said hydrothermal vents are deadly to the origin of life. Because what you would have would be these prebiotic chemicals circulating through the hydrothermal vents where they would get destroyed. And what you really need for the origin of life is some place where you get dehydration. That's a challenge because the primordial Earth had water everywhere. And life originated in the waters where there wasn't this. But for a naturalistic pathway for the origin of life, conditions must start off wet and become dry. And that's not going to happen in a hydrothermal vent. In a hydrothermal vent, you've got temperatures that are too high, and they will break down the critical molecules.
Well, I wonder why these people are throwing this out as the first. If I've read it correctly, why they're throwing.
Well, here's why: because at these hydrothermal vents, you get this rich panoply of carbonaceous molecules, but there's certain molecules you don't see that are critical for the origin of life. And what we see in these hydrothermal events, we don't see any nucleotides, we don't see any 5-carbon sugars, and we don't see any amino acids. These all get broken down. But you do see literally 100 different carbonaceous molecules. Say, look at all those molecules, something must happen, is going to let them come together. And you've got lots of energy. I mean, the hydrothermal events pouring out heat, so you've got an energy source that can drive chemistry. However, and then they've taken those same carbonaceous molecules in the lab and have been able to pull them together to make amino acids and nucleotides. But, you know, it was just this past few weeks that Dr. No died. Dr. No is Robert Shapiro. And the issue of astrobiology I got just this past Friday had an obituary. A tribute to the famous astrobiologist Dr. No. He was a chemist at New York University, and he was called Dr. No because even though he was an atheist at all these origin of life research conferences, he would stand up and said, the RNA world hypothesis for the origin of life is physically impossible. What you guys are doing in your chemistry lab experiments is brilliant chemistry, but it's irrelevant to the origin of life. The lab conditions do not emulate what happens in a hydrothermal event. They don't emulate the conditions of anywhere on planet Earth 3.8 billion years ago. And so Robert Shapiro died a skeptic. In fact, he wrote a book called Origins, A Skeptic's Guide to the Origin of Life on Planet Earth, basically saying every pathway we can think of for a naturalistic origin of life doesn't work. And we don't have an answer yet. Nevertheless, he was convinced that if we continue researching, we will find an answer. Although I do remember attending an Origin of Life research conference where he stood up and said, you know, all day long we've been hearing these lectures on what we've been able to accomplish in our chemistry labs. And he says, brilliant chemistry, very exquisite, but it's simply proving the intelligent design argument. You need all this intelligence and investment in order to produce these results, and what we need are experiments that are actually realistic and relevant to the origin of life on planet Earth. And he says, so far all day long, I haven't heard anything that's relevant to the actual origin of life. So that's a tribute to Dr. No. Yes.
Do you ever have God conferring with you about the origins of life? And
stuff? Oh, certainly. It's in Genesis 1. It's in Deuteronomy 32. So he does. He communicates to all of us about how he pulled it all together.
Specifically you. You probably got a genius IQ that's off the... I'm trying my best to... kind of follow, but I just either you're incredibly smart or I'm incredibly stupid. Well, if you put it that way.
Boy, you walked into that one.
Alan, he does a terrible Groucho impression, though.
Well, that's something I said before in the class. I mean, God makes each one of us different. And we all have talents that exceed that of any other human being on the planet. We also all have defects that are score miserably compared to the rest of the human population. And just so you know, I took a very sophisticated IQ test when I was 16 years of age. It lasted all day. And it was done through a psychologist actually interviewed me and tested me all day. And she said, I got the highest scores on many parts of the test, and I got the lowest scores on many parts of the test.
You told me the lowest scores was basically people skills, and look at you now.
Well, that's true. I mean, I remember going in as a freshman at the University of British Columbia, and at that time, back in the 60s, it was a real pressure cooker. They failed half the students every year. And so, yeah, I mean, it was stress you. And so they had a requirement that all of us had to take a battery of tests, and we had to have a personal interview with one of the university psychologists. And so I had this hour-long interview with this psychologist, and his comment was, I've looked at your test scores. You'll be successful at anything you pursue in a course of studies on this campus, at any level you want to pursue, with one proviso. It must not involve people. So your scores on the people things.
Was this physics? Was this when you...
When he found out I was going to go into astrophysics, he says, that's perfect. And you know what's interesting is in astrophysics, you have a very high proportion of individuals whose people skills are pretty... not very good.
So how
right?
do you account for your people skills being very good?
Well,
Kathy.
My wife helps, but another thing that was a big turnaround for me was signing my name in the back of a Gideon Bible at age 19, giving my life to Christ, and making a commitment to let Christ begin to build character in me and give me attributes I didn't have. Because one of the things I saw when I went through the Bible after 2 years study was becoming a Christian meant that you had to begin to share your faith with other people, which meant I was going to have to interact with people. And I knew I had problems. As I told the psychologist at the University of British Columbia, he said, look, I know my people skills are horrible. That's why I've made it a point to do public speaking. I started public speaking when I was 16. And I can tell you that when I was in my youth doing public speaking, it wasn't anything fun to look at. But you keep trying. And for me, it was partly my desire to instruct people, but it was also a recognition I needed therapy. And that was kind of my therapy. If you keep doing it often enough, you eventually develop some of the skills you need. But it's still true. I can't read people's emotions. I can't read people's body language. And so often when you ask me questions here, I misunderstand what you're saying. A lot of people comment on that. Hugh, that was a great answer to a question, but it wasn't my question. So something I continue to struggle with.
Can I give away all my belongings and just follow you?
No, what you need to do is find out the gifts and talents that God has given you. And one thing I've shared before in the class is this. One of the ways of determining the pathway that Christ has you moving on and the purpose for your life is to look at your defects. As it says in 2 Corinthians 4, we all are cracked jars. Every human being is a jar that's cracked, which means God purposely gave us defects when we were born. Why? Because it tells us in 2 Corinthians 4, He wants to shine through the cracks. It's like His light is inside the jar. And if we plug up all the cracks and made our external thing perfect, so we look good to everybody in every way, His light can't shine through. You know, in one sense, you know, people recognize the Holy Spirit at work within me because they recognize the defects. And, you know, the Lord's light shines through anyway. And that's what God, or Paul tells us in 2 Peter 4. God wants people to realize that what people are seeing coming out of you is not from you, but from Him. And that can only happen if you don't try to repair the cracks and let God shine through those cracks inside that jar. And therefore, He blesses each of us with defects. So find out what your defects are. Find out where your weaknesses are. And that will be a guide to where God wants to bring you and transform you. Yes.
We're at that point in time where we're taking no more questions or comments so we can get through some of these slides.
Okay, let's go. All right. Anyway, this at least gives you a feel for why that inequality must be real. Can't be any broader than 100,000 years, but you need 14 billion years to get there. And then we also recognize that it takes time to get the continents just right. I think I covered this last week, that if you want advanced life, you want the continents to cover about 29% of the surface area of the Earth. 30% is not so good, and 28% is not so good. You want to be right at 29, that's where you are right now. I remember hearing a lecture from Peter Ward, the paleontologist, who said as we move on to the future, the continent of the landmass is going to be 30 and 31%, and when that happens, human civilization is over. because at that point we're not going to get the recycling of the nutrients. We're going to have rainfall patterns that are not going to be as optimal as they are right now, and this will be an issue that will be detrimental to advanced life. But right now, conditions are ideal. Well, notice how long it took us to get there, and notice that that's not a permanent situation. The other thing is that it takes a certain size of the continents and orientation of the continents. Not only must the continents cover 29% of the surface area of the Earth, you want the continents to be well separated. If they're all together, then you're going to have huge portions of land area that won't get adequate rainfall. You want to be relatively close to the oceans in order to get the rainfall that you need. You also want the mountains to be oriented a situation. And this is a good thing you see with North and South America. They're oriented north and south. And the big mountain ranges are oriented north and south. And so this optimizes the rainfall patterns on the continental land masses. And keep in mind that in order to have optimal civilization, you need rain in solid form, or precipitation in solid form and liquid form. That's something you see in Job 37, how God has blessed humanity with three different kinds of liquid precipitation and three different kinds of frozen precipitation. So it talks about the frost, it talks about the hail and the snow in terms of the frozen precipitation. Why do you need that? Because it takes time, based on the way God designed water, for ice to melt and become liquid. Which means that here in California, we have a perfect example of that. We live in an area where it's warm, but we have a mountain range with mountains that are 14,000 feet high. And right now, those mountains are accumulating frozen precipitation. Literally, 20, 30, 40 feet of snow covers the high Sierras. And that snow melts slowly during the hot months of the year. And so if you were to go to the high Sierras, even in late August, where the snow is the least, there's still snow there. And therefore, we have permanent flowing streams of creeks and the rivers that enable agriculture to be sustained 12 months of the year. And that's important that it be happening all over the world. The other reason why you want the continents oriented north-south, this forces the ocean currents to flow north-south, which gives maximum oxygenation in the oceans, which sustains the maximum biomass in the oceans, which is important because for most of the world, a lot of their protein comes from the seas. And also, it ameliorates the climate. I mean, look how far north Norway is, and yet it's relatively warm. That's because of the Gulf Stream. And one thing that I've noticed coming here to California from British Columbia, your water here is actually colder than our water. So, I made the mistake of going in swimming without a wetsuit here in California when I first arrived from British Columbia. And I don't have a lot of body fat on me, so I got chilled in a hurry and had to come out. And that's when I decided to invest in a wetsuit just so I could enjoy surfing and snorkeling here. But I can tell you where I grew up in British Columbia, wasn't necessary to wear a wetsuit. The water is actually warmer than it is here in California, and that's because the Japanese current is cool here in California and warm when it reaches British Columbia and goes up into Alaska. And so it's more pleasant in Anchorage, for example, than it otherwise would be without that Japanese current. Well, something that I didn't get to share with you at all last week is that we happen to live at the ideal ice age moment. I mean, what if we were here 90,000 years ago? At that time, all of Canada was covered with ice thousands of feet thick, and half of the United States was covered with ice 1,000 feet thick. And as you can see here, and maybe we can dim the light here because you can't really see the continents. This is Africa here, and this is Spain. Spain didn't have a thick ice cap, but notice once you get into France, they're covered by ice. All of Germany was covered by ice. So most of Europe was underneath ice, which means that you couldn't really have global civilization. And when God created Adam and Eve, where did he create them? In what is now the bottom of the Persian Gulf, where it would have been warm enough that they could sustain some local civilization. But it required the melting of the ice from the Ice Age to sustain human civilization over the whole of the planet. And in many respects, we're the beneficiaries of living at after the close of the last ice age, because what's happening? Ice all over the world is melting. Now, because of human activity, it's melting a little faster than would be ideal. But for thousands of years, humanity was a beneficiary of residual ice from the ice age melting and providing us with strong flowing rivers that could sustain civilization. So, for example, what you see in Genesis 2 is that you've got four rivers watering the Garden of Eden. Talks about the Gihon, the Pishon, the Tigris, and the Euphrates. Well, at the close of the last ice age, all four rivers were mighty flowing rivers because they were being fed by the melting of ice from the last ice age. But today, the Gihon and the Pishon are dry riverbeds. Satellite imagery, I should probably bring you a slide that shows you this next week. I can try to do that. You can actually see the ancient riverbeds for the Gihon and the Pishon flowing through southern Arabia into the Persian Gulf. But today, they don't flow. Why don't they flow? Because all the ice that sustained those rivers has melted away. The Tigris and Euphrates still flow because a lot of their water flow comes from mountains that are 15 to 17,000 feet high where there's still snow that melts. But there will come a time in the relatively near future where the Tigris and the Euphrates likewise will become dry. But this is a phenomenon we see all over the world where the great rivers are being fed by the melting of ice that dates back to the last ice age. So, for example, a third of the world's fresh flowing water comes from the mountains along the Canadian Rocky Mountain Trench. But I can tell you, that water is coming from glaciers that are the residual from the last ice age. It's not that they're getting a lot of rainfall. You don't get a lot of rainfall or snow falling in that part of the world, but we do have the melting of glaciers from the last ice age. And the receding of those glaciers is what's feeding those mighty rivers. The Mackenzie, for example, is the second biggest flowing river in the world. And it's almost entirely sustained by melting ice. That's also true of the Fraser, the Columbia, the Stickeen, which are also major rivers that flow from that region. So I think that gives you a feel that, you know, ice ages go through a 100,000-year cycle. But there's about a 10,000-year-wide window when the ice age is at the ideal point in its cycle to sustain high technology global civilization. And so when God created Adam and Eve, we did not have global high technology civilization. What you see it after the flood is humanity for the first time becomes global, but the high technology civilization isn't there. If the ice had to melt sufficiently that you could actually sustain that global high technology civilization. So we are living at the ideal time in the ice age. Now that kind of gives you a feel because with the sun, it tells you the window can't be broader than 100,000 years, but every 100,000 years we get an ice age. And it's approximately like this. You get 90,000 years of significant coverage of the planet with ice, followed by a 10,000-year interglacial. But because of human civilization activity, we've made that now 15,000 years wide. We're about 5,000 years overdue for an ice age based on the orbit of the Earth about the sun. But because of human activity, we've been able to extend the warm interglacial. But there's a limit to how much you can extend it. And I think what's quite challenging is there are studies that show that global warming will hasten the advent of the next ice age. For example, if you start shutting down these north-south flowing ocean currents, that could begin to bring about an ice age because that might change the rainfall patterns. I mean, what builds up the ice over Siberia and Canada is the fact that those regions, which today are deserts, begin to have higher rainfall. And because of how cold they are, the rain doesn't come down as liquid. It comes down in a frozen form, and that builds up ice caps that are thousands of feet thick over those regions. And so this is why there's concern about the fact that the Arctic ice cap is disappearing, because Siberia and Canada are still very cold. and if you shift the rainfall patterns to those regions. You may not realize, but northern Canada gets less than 10 inches of rain a year, likewise Siberia, and yet they have all these forests. Well, it's cold enough that even with that small amount of precipitation, you can sustain that vegetation. But what if it becomes 20 inches a year? Then, instead of forests, you get an ice cap. Anyway, we're out of time. We'll pick this up next time. But I think I'm going to, you're getting the idea that it's not just one time window, there's multiple time windows, and you've got to get all the time windows lining up, which is why I believe that Frank Tipler and John Barrow were too conservative. We're not looking at 41,000 years, we're looking at something that's probably in the order of 15,000 to 20,000 years, as opposed to something as broad as 41,000 years. Now, unless you get really pessimistic and saying, the world is going to come to an end. God has us here for a purpose. He's placed us here on this planet under the most optimal conditions that can possibly exist in the history of the earth. We need to realize we are living at the best time in the 4.57 billion year history of the earth for human global civilization. But it's a brief window of time, which means God must have a plan in effect for Him to use the human species to fulfill its purpose relatively quickly. So I believe that we're going to fulfill the Great Commission in centuries, not millennia, because conditions aren't going to be benign for that much longer. And hey, once evil has been conquered and removed once and for all, there's no longer any need for the universe, no longer any need for planet Earth. And at that point, God can replace this universe with a brand new realm, the new creation. You can read about it and why the universe is the way it is. Father in heaven, we want to thank you, Lord, for putting us on this wonderfully designed planet. And then your fine-tuning of this planet and our entire solar system, for that matter, over the past 4.5 billion years to give us such amazingly optimal conditions, both in terms of the physical conditions of our planet and all the life that exists on this planet with us. Lord, I pray that you would give us a grateful spirit during this time we celebrate the coming of the Creator of the universe to planet Earth, to come as a human being, to live amongst us, to give us an example of humility of how we can come to you and receive salvation and receive your Holy Spirit that can transform us and prepare us for life for all of eternity and the new creation. In Jesus' name, amen.
Is there scientific evidence for a different dimension of time?